This is Wide Open, a series on how to embrace change and challenge your ways of thinking so you can level up your life, open up to new experiences, and pay it forward to those who need it. I'm your host, Tony Gonzalez. Today's guest is Ed Mylett. Ed's one of the world's top motivational speakers and performance experts, whose best-selling books, Max Out Podcast, and powerful stream of daily advice have helped millions of people. Listen to Ed's take on fear being your barrier to greatness, being born to make a difference in other people's lives, and how to truly maintain happiness. It's going to be a great one. Let's get wide open. All right, guys. Thanks for tuning in. Wide Open, the podcast. I'm your host, Tony Gonzalez. And today, I have a the pleasure to introduce Ed Mylett. Ed, I've met you by going on your podcast.
That's right.
Well, that was not even that long ago, right?
Two weeks ago. Thank you for doing it. You were unbelievable.
Oh, wait. Shoot, you made it so easy. It was great. But a little bit of background to the listeners out there. Most people probably listen to my show are going to know definitely what your show is. But you have your podcast. And I mean, brag a little bit about it because I don't know that much as far as listeners and all that stuff like that. I mean,
I've started it about a year and a half ago only. It's in the top 10, you know, regularly in the world. It's business, life strategy, personal development. I cover everything. This week I had I've had the guy who killed Osama bin Laden on. I've had NFL football players on.
Yeah.
This week, you're crushing it. Yeah, it's fun. I love doing it. It's called Max Out. It's just about having people max out various areas of their life. And I've enjoyed doing it. I've learned a lot from the guests, and hopefully, you know, my audience likes it too.
So no, I'm loving it. I love being on it. And that's what's kind of like what I'm doing right here. It's why I'd open the podcast. It's all, and the way I look at that too, people are always like, hey, what about competition and all that stuff? I'm like, look, we're all in this together.
100%.
We're all getting people to level up and be the best version of themselves. So
absolutely. I love doing this. And the podcast world has exploded. Mm-hmm. Like you're talking about downloads. I mean, the amount of people who consume their content this way now, compared to old school TV, blows my mind.
No,
how many
crazy
people listen to it every single week? So my outcome is to, you know, grow the whole pie for everybody, and you know, everybody's piece will be plenty big if we do that.
Yeah, but obviously, so you're into helping people be the best version of themselves, helping motivate people, coaching, business coaching, all strategy. That's because you have a background at that. And this is where I purposely didn't do as much research as I normally do on somebody because I want to sit here, I want to be in real time with you.
Okay.
I know you're from Diamond Bar.
Yeah, that's right.
which is Southern California.
Correct.
And which is where I'm from a little bit. Back, by the way, when I was younger, they used to have this track and field event out in Diamond Bar.
Cal Poly.
And we used to go there.
Mount Sac Relays. That's right.
I used to go there because I was looking for girls back then. And the track girls were the best out there back when I was in high school.
Yeah, well, thank God. I met my wife in Diamond Bar in kindergarten, ironically. And
that's
we've
crazy
been together to this day. And she's smoking hot, so it's kind of crazy.
Well, they were hot out there.
I closed her young. That was the cool part. Like, she didn't really know what she was getting into.
That's amazing.
And here we are a million years later, married to this day.
And we're going to talk about that for sure because marriage is tough. Relationships are tough. And so I got to hear about your keys and strategies. So.
Yeah, well, I've made a lot of the mistakes. I can give you those.
Oh, good. Sure. We'll take those. Okay. So you're growing up in Diamond Bar. What was it like in Diamond Bar? What kind of area? You just said it was all white kids, right?
Yeah, no, not when I grew up there. My kindergarten class had that. I grew up like lower middle class, I would say. So we weren't poor from the standpoint that there wasn't food on my table when I was a little kid. You know, there was always a Christmas at Christmas time, but you know, I never took a vacation. We didn't have money to like vacation from where we were, but I had a loving family. You know, I would say that one of the great, I have this big thing. I believe that everything in your life happens for you, not to you. I did grow up in like a dysfunction though. My dad, real serious drinking problem when I was a kid, got sober as I got older. He's my best friend now, but I grew up in one of those families that there's just anxiety, you know, when you're a kid. And so financially things were decent, but inside the house, if you walked through our front door and you could see what was going on there, it was a little rough from time to time.
When you talk about rough from time to time, but how did that, if you don't mind giving examples?
Yeah.
I'm
the oldest boy of three little girls, and my dad would kind of know when he was going to go on one of his binges. You know what I mean?
Okay.
By the way, it's awkward for me to say this because he's my hero, because he's been sober 30 years now.
Yeah.
But there'd be times where he'd be gone, you know, wouldn't come back. And so, you know, you'd be looking for dad at night. Where is he? Did he come home? Everything happens for you in hindsight. So one of the few skills I have, and I don't have that many, is I'm really good at assessing people, reading them. And that comes from at 5 years old, when my dad walked through the front door, I'd have to assess, is this sober, loving, happy dad? Or is this dad's been drinking, frustrated, grumpy, tired, maybe mean dad? Uh-huh. And I'd have to read that every day when he'd come through that front door to discern how he was going to treat mom and my sisters and me, right? Uh-huh. And so there was that type of a thing. I don't think I had one of those childhoods where I was ever a kid. You know, yeah. He would tell me, when I'm gone, you take care of your mom and the girls. Almost like I was the protector of the family sometimes at 5 years old. So I just remember as a little boy, tons of anxiety, always worried. Are they going to divorce? Is dad coming back? Which dad am I going to get? And so I think I grew up really soon. You know uh-huh. what I mean? Really soon. And I think all that sort of hurt my self-esteem too as a kid.
So how did that affect you at school and with your relationships-wise? Were you angry because of that? Were you, obviously you weren't inverted, or at least—
I was introverted. I am, actually. It's ironic.
Well, I mean, in the sense of like, were you a shy? Were you
super shy, bro.
Really?
Like unbelievably shy. I wasn't a big enough dude to be allowed to be angry. Uh-huh. So I was the small kid. Even though I was a really good athlete, but I was just saying that to use a little bit ironic, but I was a really good athlete, mm-hmm. But super introverted, super shy, extremely insecure, bullied my entire time as a little boy in school until I became a really good athlete. Once it sort of shown as I got older, was Duke could play, then the bullying kind of went away, but real quiet, not a lot of friends, super shy. And it carries over to this day. Like I, most of people that know me well would say I'm the most introverted person that they know, unless it's a topic I love. If it's a sport or personal development or business, I can talk all day long. But you get me in a social setting, I'm the dude in the back of the room hiding in the corner. If I'm at the mall, this is so sad too, but I'm at the mall or something and I'll see someone from high school coming the other way, I'll duck into a store. You know, hide on the road when I'm traveling. I love room service.
Yeah,
it gives me anxiety even just to go out still to this day. So I've had to really, that's why I'm in personal development. I had to work on all these things to be a baseline human.
Yeah.
I had to get good at self-confidence, good at communication, good at influence, good at being happier.
Yeah.
You know, because I lacked all of it as a child.
So what, by what age? When did you finally say, okay, this is, that's not how I'm going to be?
Great question, Tony. I'd say early 20s, I went to a Tony Robbins seminar. Uh-huh. And he used to do these things where he'd cure phobias. And so one of the phobias that day was public speaking. And my little team I was in, Eddie. And we get called up on the stage. He made you give a speech.
Uh-huh.
So like 30 of us get up there and give a speech. And it was just terrifying. I literally almost peed myself. Like I was going to pass out. I was going blank, like in and out of consciousness almost. And then I talked and like, wow. When I was done at the intermission, they said, Tony would like to talk to you. And I walked backstage and he goes, I've not said this before. He goes, I think you might be the most gifted speaker I've ever seen.
Uh-huh.
Please pursue this. And I was like, what? He goes, I'm just telling you, please pursue it. 2 years later, I was on stage touring with him.
Really?
And I think the lesson in that for me was, man, like sometimes on the other side of massive fear.
Yeah.
This isn't a saying either. I mean this. Sometimes on the other side of massive fear is your great gift.
Oh, I love that.
Or a great rewarding. And like I stumbled into this because I conquered this monster fear. It's almost like that fear is the barrier to get to your greatness.
Yeah.
And once that went away, and I've had that example happen in a few other things in my life too. So like I kind of chase fear now. I hate it.
Yeah.
But I chase fear because there's always a gift on the other side. It could be a gift of a reward, but it also could be a gift about you didn't know you possessed.
Yeah.
And so something I'm addicted to doing now, but that was probably the first example in my life. I went, this is changing now.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I'm very similar. I always say life takes off on the other side of fear. I know my life.
I love
that. And I think we talked about that when I was on your podcast, that is the greatest gift. That's the most, life happens for you, not, life happens to you. Is that what you said?
Happens for you, not to you.
That's along that same lines. Like anything that you're going through, it's going to make you better.
It does. And the key to a happy life, see, we all know that. Like we say, hey, life happens for you. Everything that's ever happened negative, didn't it end up being kind of something you learned or improved from? And you always know it in hindsight.
Yeah.
The question is, can you begin to live your life in such a way that you know it in present time? That as you're experiencing that adversity, as you're experiencing the fear, in that moment, you can accept the truth. This is happening for me. Like my dad, driving out here, my dad's got cancer. Mm-hmm. He's in chemo right now.
Yeah.
And like his third bout. What the hell? How is that happening for me?
Yeah.
How is it good that my dad's got cancer? Because there's a ton of negatives. But candidly, he's had it for a couple years. It's changed my life for the better. Now, I don't want to lose my father. It's horrible. But the for me part, I take my own relationships with my kids completely differently. When the phone rings now, I'll be honest, when it was my dad before, if I was busy, I'm like, I'll call him back.
Yeah.
Now I pick it up. Hey, Dad. Mm-hmm. My dad tells me he loves me 100 times more than he ever did before. Yeah. Our relationship's different. Time is precious with him. it's ironically been an incredible gift in all of those other ways. My own health and mortality, I'm more aware of all of a sudden because my dad's going through it.
Yeah.
So I've embraced this is happening for me, not to our family, even as we're going through this really hard time now. And it's made me happier.
Okay. How do you fight for that though? I mean, because like you said though, why it's happening, is that something, is there a technique that you can use to say, you know what, the shit's coming down all around me right now. How do you pause?
Yeah, I pause. So I'm intentional about it. Mm-hmm. I'm a huge believer in the power of intention and awareness. So when these negative thoughts creep in, whatever they are, fear, I'm aware of my own thinking. And once you're aware of a thought, it loses its power to have a feeling over you. Mm-hmm. This is what most people don't understand. So we're all going to have those thoughts like, oh, I'm losing my dad. It's a horrible thing. When you're aware of that negative thought, the feeling loses its power over you. One of the things that I think people need to start to understand is, if you don't align your thoughts and your feelings, neither one has any power. There has to be a congruency between what you're thinking and what you're feeling. That's why, like, for example, when people set up all these goals, I'm gonna make $1 million, or I'm gonna go to the NFL, or I'm gonna be happy, or I'm gonna lose 20 pounds. In the moment you're having that thought, if you're feeling that you can't have it, if you're feeling that's not going to happen, your body, which is your unconscious mind actually at work, the feeling overrides the thought and that goal has no power. That's why, like, when you played on my show, I was going to say this to you afterwards, and I didn't. You're talking about how you'd visualize these things happening. One of the things about visualization that happens is if you put yourself in the movie of your life, you begin to feel what it feels like to catch that pass in the end zone.
Uh-huh.
So the thought is simultaneous with the feeling. So if you can begin to visualize what your goals are and allow yourself to feel it in the present time, and there's the gift I'll give you. If you could already experience gratitude for an event or a goal that has not yet happened, but you can experience the gratitude. So when you'd have these visualizations, you probably didn't know you were doing it when you played, but you're visualizing the catch. You're visualizing the celebration. You're already in a gratitude state about having received the goal you have.
Yep.
Now you've aligned in congruence your feelings with your thoughts. Now you're a powerful MF-er. Uh-huh. But what most people do in their life is they either have the conscious thoughts overridden by their like, lack. I have never done this before. I'm not going to do it. I've always been 20 pounds overweight. I don't have $1 million in the bank. And they write down all these goals that aren't linked with the feeling. People say, well, how do I get the feeling? You get the feeling by having gratitude for the event before it's happened.
Yeah.
So gratitude would be my answer. I'm trying to find the thing I'm grateful for during this event in the present time.
Yeah.
Oh, that's the override.
I love that. And you know, it's so, a lot of the people that have sat in this chair, that's how they think. And some people call that just, I'm confident. Mm-hmm. I know before it's even going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Visualization, all that stuff. It's funny how the magic is there. That's like a huge part of it.
Yeah, it's a magic and it's an alignment in my opinion. So there's what happens when you listen to the podcast like mine is that you pick up little pieces, but if you don't have them in context, so you have to have gratitude, you have to have all that, but self-confidence, you're doing a huge thing. Self-confidence is the process of keeping promises you make to yourself,
mm-hmm.
big and small, getting up in the morning at a certain time, drinking a certain amount of water, amount of contacts you're going to make in your business. When I meet someone who lacks self-confidence, because I've lacked it in my life, that's a person who has repeatedly not kept promises they make to themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Self-confidence is self-trust. So if you start to have that magic formula of self-trust and self-confidence, which is you start with small things and keep these promises you make to yourself, plus visualization, plus the goal written down, now it's very hard to lose.
Mm-hmm.
But if you lack the self-confidence piece, you can have all the goals, all the feelings in the world, you're gonna lose.
Yeah.
So it's this formula of confidence, the visualization, the feeling, and the thought that's the recipe usually to win.
Yeah, so take me back to you talk about visualization in sports. You played baseball.
I did, yes.
And is that when it started to kind of come together for you when you started saying, okay, this is, because I know that obviously that's how it worked out for me is sports.
Yeah.
Is that what happened for you?
Yeah, to equate our athletic careers would be pretty hilarious. but I did play college baseball and had a chance to go play after that too. My sophomore year, I got hit with a pitch, sort of catastrophic injury where a tumor formed on my calf. Part of my calf was removed multiple times and that sort of derailed the future of my career, but it was a gift. Again, uh-huh. it happened for me.
Uh-huh.
Here's the gift part. I couldn't play for 6 months. We had a team psychologist, which most college teams didn't have. And he goes, Eddie, what I want you to do is during BP, batting practice, I want you to sit behind the cage and all you're going to do is visualize line drives up the middle. My freshman year, I hit like 280.
Uh-huh.
Line drive up the middle. And he'd make me visualize. And then he would take me through the details. He goes, okay, what are you seeing? And I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, well, where's the camera? Is the camera behind home plate you're looking out? Or is the camera in center field you're looking in? I'm like, I don't know. So he would force me to specifically visualize like a professional. I go, okay, it's center field. Okay, cool. Where's the ball coming out of? Is the pitcher right or left-handed? I didn't know.
Yeah.
He's right-handed. Okay, when he releases the ball, do you see the release point? No, see it. See the release point. Okay, can you see the rotation of the stitches? Is it a curveball or fastball? It'd make me slow down where I could count the stitches on the ball. So people think they visualize, is my point. They don't visualize in great specificity and clarity. So he made the visualization so much more specific that as the ball would come in, he got me to the point where I could see the ball hit the bat, which I couldn't before. And I could see the rotation of the stitches start to go the other way off the bat. Uh-huh. Anyway, I do this like thousands of times for 6 months. I take my first batting practice as a pretty average hitter. And the first 27 straight balls over my head in the dirt, line drive up the freaking middle. I couldn't miss. Then I popped one up and I hit 16 more up the middle. Uh-huh. The next year I led the nation in hitting. And what he said to me that was fascinating, man, is after I had that good year, I thanked him. And he goes, you know why you had that year? I said, no. He goes, because you atrophied, you lost weight, you weren't in great shape. He said, you didn't ground out or pop out for 6 months.
Uh-huh.
For 6 months, every single thing I did was a line drive up the middle. I had no real world losses because your unconscious mind doesn't know the difference between an imagined event and a real one. So what I was doing is I was having the thought of hitting that ball up the middle and anchoring the feeling in my body with a little self-confidence, and it changed me in hitting. So that switched my having no clue about visualization and goal setting and self-confidence to flipping it completely, and then I use it in business.
What do you say to people, though, because you listened? Mm-hmm. And that's another big thing that I'm finding. The people that have gone on to have success, and I know that's how it was in my case, too. It's like, okay, I read all these books about greatness, and I could watch these people on my team that are doing really, really well, and I said, okay, well, I'm going to apply that, and I'm going to do it, where people are surrounded by that, but they don't. They see it, they see the examples, but they can't apply it for whatever reason. What do you say to them? And some people are self-aware of that. Most people are. They're like, shit, I can't get out of it. Why can't I take what I'm learning and apply it?
Yeah, that is something that you're great at. So you embody this. After we met you, I went home. She goes, what did you think of Tony? I said, I was struck by his humility for such a successful man. Very humble guy. And so first off, knowledge isn't power. It's potential power. And it's only powerful when it's applied, as you've said. I actually think the separator for people who apply and don't apply is ego. I really think I don't know everything. I really do want to learn. I do have a level of humility about most things that I'm a student all the time. And when I look at a guy like you, and I was listening to all the things you're talking about in your career and how aware you are, and frankly, how candid you are about things you wish you did differently, it takes a ton of humility. And so I think if you're not applying things, you need to look at yourself and decide whether your ego is involved. You'd say, well, no, I'm just afraid. Ego is fear. Mm-hmm. Ego applies itself in lots of different ways, but probably the fact that you're not applying what you're learning is ego-related in some way. That's what I would evaluate if I was that person. Mm-hmm.
I always say ego has no amigo. I say that on the show, huh? It's a good one.
I like that. I'm going to steal it.
What piece of advice, kind of piggybacking that, what's something that, I guess, Ed sitting here right now, could go back and tell the young Ed, what would you say, hey, you should listen to this one?
Wow, there's a million things, because I lack so much confidence. I would have first told myself, hey, man, you deserve to be successful. Uh-huh. This isn't relegated to people different than you. Yeah. I used to think, who are these people that live in these beach houses and have these jets or play on TV in a sport? They're like a different species or something. And as I've got to know them all from doing my show and just from living my life, they're just like you in many ways. They're just human. They have the same emotions, the same weaknesses and whatnot. But here's the deal, man. Your life, you're probably never going to exceed your identity. Mm-hmm. And that your identity is the thoughts and concepts that you believe to hold really to be true about yourself. Mm-hmm. And you have multiple identities. You have a happiness one, a wealth one, a fitness one, a relationship one. And you will never, temporarily, you could get a better result than what you believe you're worth, but you'll find a way to cool it back down. Your identity is like that thermostat on the wall.
Uh-huh.
It sets the temperature for your life. So if you're a 75 degree, or let's just say of wealth, and you live at 75 degrees, you might get it going for a while in business and you're living at 80, 85 degrees, but all of a sudden the thermostat of your life will kick in unconsciously and you will find a way to cool it right back down.
Uh-huh.
Reverse is true too. You start going broke, you can't pay your bills. You'll find a way eventually, don't you? You didn't starve, you didn't get homeless, you heated your life back up to what you think you're worth.
Yeah.
And it governs your life. It doesn't matter the external conditions. If you have a thermostat in this room, 100 degrees outside, it'll still regulate this room to 75.
Yeah.
And so your identity is a thermostat of your life. And if you don't change the thoughts, concepts, and worth you hold to be true about yourself, all of the other mechanical things you do, you will find a way. Most Hall of Fame athletes simply have a higher identity about their craft and their career. Most high performers in fitness, high performers in a relationship, people in faith, their faith. You see, someone just lives with great faith. They've got 150 degrees of faith. And so they get that no matter what the conditions are. There's a woman on my show today, Tony, who was the mother of a 5, 4, and 2-year-old, Kayla Stockline. Her husband was pastor of a church. He hung himself last year in their church, committed suicide, and left 3 children behind and a loving wife and a church full of people. And on my show, she says that the last year, her faith has only increased and she's closer to God. How in the world is that possible? It's because no matter what the conditions of her life is, she's got this gigantic faith identity. So my thing I'd go back and tell me is, you better work on this identity thing all the time, bro. You better keep working on it, or you will find a way to cool your life back down in every area to what you think you're worth and what you think you deserve.
And the way you do that, though, is what? Would you write it down? Great. Is it something, like affirmation? How do you do that?
Great questions. For me, there's 2 ways I've found to move your identity the most. One is the power of association. Hear this all the time. Your life's going to be the 5 people. But it's have specificity with your associations. Like, if you want to be a richer person, you must begin to seek out a group of people around you who are more successful financially than you. And if I'm 100-degreer financially and you're 75-degreer, through proximity over time, I get you to 85 or 90 degrees. Proximity equals power. So in fitness too, if you're 35 pounds overweight and everybody you're hanging out with eats greens and clean all the time and trains 5 days a week, you will over time change your fitness identity. If you have a very low threshold of faith, you kind of believe, but it's ebb and flow. And the 5 people around you most of the time are these strong believers in whatever their faith is. They heat you up somewhere in between your identity and theirs. So what I do is I'm constantly, aggressively seeking out new associations to add to my life and trying to get them closer to me. The second way is, in a short window of time, do something psycho. In a short window of time, trick your system. Oh my God, I'm not that new person. Do a big amount of activity in a short window of time, and you often recalibrate the myelin in your brain, the wiring in your brain, and it's almost like a new watermark in a pool. It's just higher, right? You just have a different watermark. So it's either short bursts of crazy activity or associations are the 2 ways.
So when you're younger, though, I hear the way you're talking now, but you graduate from college, 3-time All-American, and then you go into the business world.
Yeah.
How were you, did you go in like this with this attitude that you're having now? Because obviously you had great success, and the little research I did do on you, though, I do know that you accelerated very, very quickly in your job, right?
Yeah, and I was young, I did pretty well. What happened was, and I don't want to bore people with the background, but it's important to know, I was an ego-driven person when I was young. And by the way, I still fight it. I think all successful people are constantly towing that line of ego and strength, right? Yeah. So I still do. Anybody around me, my wife would definitely tell you, trust me, he's not always winning that battle. However, a great gift happened for me. Again, my dad's drinking. My dad got sober that year, and he was at an AA meeting. And I was unemployed, living at home after college with my parents. Same bedroom, same teddy bear, same posters. Losing. And my dad comes home from an AA meeting and goes, I got you a job. 6 a.m. tomorrow morning, you show up at McKinley Home for Boys. I'm like, what is it? He goes, I have no effing clue. Get your ass down there and start making some money.
Yeah.
I go down there at 6 a.m. I'm like, hey, I'm here. I didn't know what it was. What it ended up being was an orphanage. It's a group home, but a huge one. Campus, like 50 different cottages, all boys of all ages. All the boys were wards of the court. Family died, incarcerated, or had molested them.
Yeah.
I'm like, I'm here for the job. They're like, what job? I'm like, I don't know. Just I'm here. They're like, well, come back when you know what it is. And I get to the door, and I'm like, the guy's name was Tim that was going to hire me. They're like, we don't know Tim. And I start to leave and I go, well, I think he's an alcoholic because he was at an AA meeting with my dad. So I go, oh, drunk Tim, cottage 8.
Drunk Tim.
Drunk Tim. And I walk into cottage 8 and my life changed. Seriously, man. It was all little 8 to 10-year-old boys, and they stopped when I walked in. And they had these eyes. All kids who come from a little dysfunction in their life have different eyes.
Yeah.
They want to be loved. They want to be believed in. They want someone to coach them and lift them up and show them how to be better. And they stopped. And I instantly became their dad and their big brother. I'd take them trick-or-treating. I was there when they opened their Christmas presents. I was there on their birthday. And it changed my life because I was like, holy shit, I love helping people. Mm-hmm. I love this. Like, I like it more than hitting a home run. I like it more than money. And so when I was there, I kind of changed.
Yeah.
And then while I worked there, the financial company that I ended up having my first success in came along. And I honestly can tell you, man, I went into business with this idea that I'm going to love people, believe in people, and coach them. And I'm still doing it to this day. I did not go into business to make big money. I went into business to serve people. I went into business to help people. And so that was the flipped switch for me, was I got out of me and I got into them.
Yeah.
And when you're into you, it's like you're constantly thinking all the time about what they're thinking about you, what you need to say, all this stuff. Even when you're on TV or camera, sometimes just serve people, just contribute. Influence in life isn't even that people even need to believe what you're saying. This is what's crazy. People think, I got to get people to believe me. And when you get to trying to get people to believe you, you come across like a beggar. You come across desperate. Influence is not people believe me. Influence is that people believe you believe what you're saying.
Uh-huh.
They don't have to believe what you're saying. They have to believe you believe what you're saying.
Uh-huh.
And so I switched that. When I went into business, I'm like, I'm not going to always try to get people to believe everything I say. It's too much work. I can't do it. It makes me nervous. I'm going to get people to believe I believe it. And you know what? That's tremendous influence. It says, I want to help you, but I don't need you.
Yeah.
And so that was a key switch for me. And then I just started going nuts into personal development, reading books, trying to find mentors, get anybody I could to go to lunch with, pick their brain, ask them questions, just to change me. Uh-huh. So that's where it flipped for me.
I love that. Empathy, I think. Mm. Not sympathy, empathy.
Mm-hmm. Kind of what do you think the difference compassion. Is? What do you think the difference is?
You know, I just had a podcast we just shot before. Mm-hmm. Empathy and sympathy. God, that is a good one. Because Chris Voss was on here and he just explained it, because that's a big principle in his life. He said there's a difference, especially when you're negotiating, hostage negotiations. Because he's like, you can't have sympathy for somebody that, or how are you supposed to have sympathy for somebody who's an Al-Qaeda member who's killing somebody.
Mm-hmm.
But you empathize with what they're going through.
Mm.
And you have to do it from a genuine point of view so you can get to the result, which is getting everybody going home safe.
Yeah.
And keep. So for me, empathy is, to me, I guess, putting myself in their shoes. Sympathy seems like a little bit more of like feeling kind of sorry for them.
Yeah.
And I don't know how you feel about that, but that's me.
I love that example.
Off the top of my head. But it's so important. But the point that I wanted to say about that is it really does make a difference in what you're doing when you can come from a place outside of yourself. And I've said this before, that when I played football, the guy, it was crazy how when a guy had a baby, he played better. When a guy got married, he played better. Hmm. He's like in love or whatever. Yeah. When the guy's like, I got this great girl I'm in love with. Or when somebody's family, a family member passed away, they played better. And so I was always wondering, like, why? Why is that? And I never figured it out while I was playing. But now that I've been kind of reflecting on this, I think it is because you get outside of yourself when you go through those situations. But you're in love. It's no longer about you. You take yourself out of that center equation. When somebody passes away, it's not about you anymore. It's about that great life that this person that you loved lived. And that allows you to be the best version of yourself. So
what a great example.
That's why I love when you say that I go there and I see that it's not about me. It's about these kids right now. The look in their eyes that I became their father or father figure. I mean, that's when life really takes off. And most people can't get themselves out of the center of their own life.
They can't. And there's all this stuff on personal. Hey, material things will never make you happy. That's a lie. Material things can make you happy temporarily. You buy a beautiful new suit or a nice pair of shoes or a new car, you're happy, but it'll never fulfill you.
Yeah.
What fulfills you, because you were born for this. We were all born, this sounds hokey, but it's not. We were all born to make a difference in other people's lives. We were all born to do that. And when you begin to do two things in your life, when you start to figure out what some of your real gifts are, because you were all born with them. We were all born with natural gifts. It could be your intellect, your beauty, your humor, your intensity, your work ethic, your faith. You know, your problem-solving skills, whatever it is, you're all born with a few. Your nurturing skills. When you start to figure out, these are kind of two or three gifts that I do have. And then you figure out in your life how to apply those gifts in the service of other people, you're a fulfilled human being. Mm. There'll probably be a lot of money come from it too. But those are the two things. People say, how do I become more fulfilled? If you look at your heroes in life, the vast people, I don't know what my gifts are. Then who are some of your heroes? And when you start to look at your heroes in your life, you will find that even though their personality may be different than yours, what you really connect with them is they share similar gifts of yours, even though you don't think they do. Uh-huh. So even a great coach you've had, whatever it might be, that they just cared about you deeply or they were so detail-oriented. One of my heroes is Martin Luther King. I did my thesis on him in college. But what do I have in common with him, right? Uh-huh. African-American guy, civil rights movement, preacher. But it seemed to me that the things I connected with his gift to communicate. Uh-huh. I connected with his gift to serve people and move people and contribute to people. And those gifts are things that you kind of intuitively know are buried deep in you when you look at your heroes, mm-hmm. and you'll use them differently in your own life. And so one, find your gifts. Two, use them in the service of other people. And if you don't know what your gifts are, start to study your heroes and what are the things you actually really admire about them. You might even admire about them just their integrity. And that be one of your gifts, or their faith, or their strength, or their ability to overcome adversity, their toughness, right? Those are things that you know to be true about you. That's why you see them in them. That's why you acknowledge them so deeply.
Yeah. Start from nothing, stop for nothing. What does that mean?
Well, I didn't come from a whole lot, but one of the things I've seen in my life, and this is one of the things I admire, which is why I asked you off camera, what are you doing now, right? Uh-huh. You're doing this and all these other things you have going in your life. So I started from really nothing in my life, mm-hmm. but I'm not going to stop for anything. And what I find that most people do, and the reason I won't stop is because there's this incongruency between that identity thing I said earlier, what I think I'm capable of and where I am. I've never felt like, actually, I know, I've not really accomplished a whole lot yet. I've not really arrived. And the thing that I think is the saddest in life is when people don't work on their identity and all of a sudden their results do catch what they think they're worth. That's a formula for death, because you're only growing or dying in life. Once you start to exceed or catch what you think you're capable of, you stop growing and you stop. And that's when things get real dangerous in life. It's like an athlete that retires. It doesn't find the next thing. All of a sudden, these guys are running around the gym every day. They got nothing to do, idle time, and they start self-destructing. It's every career. It's not just athletes. And so what that means for me is my motto is I want to always be improving, always be growing. I always want to feel like I haven't quite made it, that there's what I'm capable of and where I am. That incongruency is this magnet that keeps pulling me forward not to stop. And I don't want to stop anymore. Like, I'm loving doing this right here, right?
Yeah.
I could be sitting on the beach. So could you. We could both be just doing nothing, which is what people think they would do when they get to that point. And some people do, and they're miserable. They might enjoy it for a week or two or 6 months, but the fact of the matter is you can't live that way. I want to always be not stopping and growing. That's what that means.
So tell me about this attitude, that everything that we're talking about, and then this age that we're in with social media and the criticism that comes with being... and not even in the spotlight. I mean, you and I, we have we have people that follow us, but just like my kid, he's 18 years old, he's got a social media account. And I see him getting depressed, whether he wants to admit it or not.
Yes.
How do you combat that with everything that's going on with technology? How do you keep a good emotional stability?
It's the number one worry I have for my kids and myself. So I'm not concerned with criticism because of the space I'm in. I don't catch too much. But it is an addiction. It's an addiction to checking your phone. It's an addiction to looking at things. Bullying at school is way different than when I was a kid. When I was a kid, you get bullied at school, you could escape at home. Now you get bullied at school and you get home and you're being bullied on Instagram. It stays on social media. It's all the time. The biggest thing that people need to realize, and this is what I try to do on my social media, I try to show my crappy days. Uh-huh. I try to show the days where I'm not doing well. Fact, ironically, it's the most engaged post that I make. Because you're catching everybody on their best day. Everybody's filtered. Everybody's showing you only the good thing. I was at a restaurant last night. There was this family screaming. The dad was pissed. This was last night at the sushi place. The dad was pissed. The wife and him didn't even make eye contact most of the meal. And the kids were a zoo. I got kids. There's a certain way my kids misbehave. But then there's a point where we're in public. It's like we're cleaning this up as a family. Right? Yeah. They were a zoo. And I'm sure they're wonderful people. Yeah. And then he asks the waiter, the server, to take a picture. Uh-huh. You'd have thought they were the Brady Bunch in this picture. It's like, ding, everyone's hugging, everyone's smiling. It was completely perfect in stage. He gives them the camera, back to freaking mayhem at the table, right? Uh-huh. And so I've just really taught my kids, hey, listen, none of this stuff is real. None of it's real. Everybody's on their worst day. And if you really want to serve people, show them your bad days. Show them the things that aren't good. I actually think the pendulum's swinging too, even in my own life. I don't think it's healthy. I think the social media, by and large, is becoming an unhealthy place. Mm-hmm. And you have to guard it. You have to have times without it. One tip I have for those of you that have kids or family, my first 30 minutes when I come home now, because it is such an addiction, I leave my phone in the car. Mm-hmm. I literally am not tempted to touch it, because too many times my kids would come in the room and I'd look down at the phone. Dad, 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 you know what a message it sends a child? That what's ever on that phone is more important than them.
Yeah.
So when I'm at lunch, I put my phone away too. It's not even out on the table face down. So the answer to that is remember that this is all staged stuff for almost everybody. Not everyone's drinking tequila, partying, dancing, having the greatest time ever when you're there. And I get my kids to get off of it, period. Off of social media as much as possible.
And you know what? It makes it harder for success too. When success comes, because if you apply all these principles that we're talking about, you're gonna have some success. Mm-hmm. You change that mindset, you're gonna change, and you change your habits and your standards and all that stuff that we've all talked about. You're gonna achieve that success. What I find is that some people can't handle it though once they get there. And I think maybe social media plays a little bit into that. How do you talk to the people that once you get success, it's hard to maintain it. I've seen it. You can be a flash in the pan.
Yep.
And I see it. You see it all the time in sports. You see it in music. Like, okay, this guy had this one hit wonder.
Yeah.
Or that guy, had, you know, he was a pro bowler, an all pro, an all star in baseball for one season, and then that was it. Mm-hmm. What about sustaining that?
I don't think you can sustain. I think you're either going to increase it or it's going to shrink. Most people never maintain that level, right? You're either going to grow. It's one of the things you and I were talking about, Brady, off camera on my show. He seems to me, I know him a little bit, you know him better than I do. I think Tom Brady seems to have an unusual dosage of humility for a person who's accomplished as much as they have. That chip is still on his shoulder from being a 6th-round pick, right?
Yeah.
And so I can almost tell when it's happening. Here's what most people want to do in their life, and this is a mistake I'll warn you of from the very beginning. They want to get to be successful so they can stop doing the work. Uh-huh. They want to get to a point where they're like, then I won't have to do what got me here. Then I won't have to grind. Then I won't have to be as hungry. And the truth of the matter is, the minute you do that, you're dying. I've made that mistake. So I don't have this illusion that the next level I get to, I can stop doing the things that got me there. It's really simple. You had a play. You had a recipe that produced the success you've got, okay? Whether that's some of your anxiety, your work ethic, whatever you did in your life. Okay, if you're trying to escape the work, if that's your goal, you're going to lose long-term. I've just accepted that I'm going to be doing some form of really hard work all the time. And once I made that negotiation with myself done, life's a lot easier. I've accepted I'm going to have to suffer to some extent, not tons of pain, but there'll be some suffering in order to win. Here's what most people are always doing. They're negotiating the price all the time. They're constantly in negotiation. Oh, it's so much work. Oh, I hope I can stop doing this. And there's this price that eventually their will to win can be bought. For most humans, their will to win can be bought. It can be bought with a championship. It can be bought with their first big contract. Uh-huh. It can be bought when they get the promotion. It can be bought when they get the house. It can be bought when they get the relationship. It can be bought when they get the car. It can be bought when they get some attention on social media. That you can buy their will to win with success. There's a price tag and they go, once I get that, you can buy my will. I just sort of decided, because I've watched it happen so much, and as long as it's legal, ethical, and moral, there's no price I'm not willing to pay. You can't buy my will to win. You can't buy me. I don't want my great-grandchildren to learn about a weaker, lesser version of me that I could have been. I have this very weird belief system. I'm a person of faith. I believe that when I go to heaven, I want the Lord to go, well done, good and faithful servant, right? Mm-hmm. But I also have this other hallucination, and I believed it for many years. I think the Lord introduces me to the destiny version of me. I think he's going to go, welcome to heaven. I'm proud of you, good and faithful servant. By the way, meet Eddie, your identical twin. This is the man I made you to be, what you were capable of, the memories you could have, the contributions, the experiences, the moments. This is the person I made in my image that you could have been, could have seen the things, done the things, become that man. My ambition in my life is when I meet that dude, we're identical twins.
Okay.
Where I go, dude, I've been chasing you all my life. And he goes, you caught me, dude. Great life. Mm. To me, that's heaven. Hell is you meet that person you were capable of, and you're complete strangers.
Yeah.
And so every decision you make in your life is getting you closer to being that man or woman or further away. To me, it'd be hell to meet who I could have been and I know nothing about them.
Uh-huh.
That to me is not an existence I want to have.
So what about the people that just want to relax?
Hmm?
What do you...
I think it's wonderful.
I
think it's great.
Do you believe them though? Do you believe if there's people out there going, yeah, you know what? That sounds like way too much and I'm happy being, you know, I don't mind... being a regular guy and I believe a regular girl. And
I believe at their current state of awareness, it's true.
Okay.
I think everyone's living in their own state of awareness, right? And so I have lots of people that are very good friends of mine that money's not their priority. Their family is their complete priority. Mm-hmm. They're very happy. I think my mom's a good example of that.
Mm-hmm.
My mom's never made a lot of money. She's not written a book. You know, she's one of the happiest people I know.
Uh-huh.
She loves her children. She contributes that way in her life. They're everything to her. I think you and I don't connect with someone who has just pockets in their life. But yeah, I actually do believe some people's current state of awareness, where they are, you know, perhaps it's true that my mother's great gifts in her life was nurturing and love and kindness. And perhaps she was planted in a family where that's where she's supposed to use those gifts. And I think she's pretty darn happy. Now, I was born with different gifts, with a different calling, with a different outcome. Now, do I believe people's awareness can change, that they're happy in their 20s a certain way, live in a certain way, and they hit 30 or have children and they go, wow, I want to be more, I want to become more? Absolutely. I don't think there's anything wrong. If you're truly happy, if you're being honest,
yeah,
if you're truly producing happiness in your life, I say congratulations to you.
Yeah.
I don't think everything is connected to achievement. I have found, though, that the vast majority of humans are only happy when they're contributing or growing or both. Uh-huh. That's what I believe. But I do, I've come to really believe that people can be happy without having to achieve every single thing in their life. Maybe that wasn't their path. How many people do you know that teach school that are never going to make more than $80,000 a year,
yeah,
that are the most happy contributory people on planet Earth because they're doing what they're called to do?
Yeah.
So I believe that.
Well, and some people get caught up in that illusion. I'm going to call it an illusion, that you think, okay, just because you have money, just because you have this status or whatever, that all of a sudden, wow, they have it all.
Yeah.
And you, which is crazy though, you see the majority of the examples, those people are some of the most, you know, miserable people out there.
I'm so glad you think that. I think that's why we're friends now. I was building a house, you know, blessed to have a bunch of money to build a house. Not as nice as this one right here, but I was building a pretty nice house about 10 years ago. And I was pissed this day. Just pissed. Everything was wrong. The contractor was screwed up. Some appointment had canceled. I'm furious. And I walk in, there's construction happening. I walk in, I'm, where is this motherfucker? You know, with my wife. There's about 10 dudes in there working. They're all from Mexico.
Yeah.
They're playing music, they're dancing, they're partying, they're having a great time. They're making 10 bucks an hour.
Yeah.
And I remember standing there going, how is it the dude building this mansion is 1/50th as happy as the dude's working on building this other man's mansion? What the hell is wrong with me?
Yeah.
And that was a lack of gratitude in my life. Those guys were grateful for what they had. Their happiness is connected to how grateful they were to be on that job, to be together, to be doing something they were great at doing, whether they were a roofer or a mason. They were great at what they did. They were using their gifts. They were happy. They were grateful. And if life was based on happiness, is that how you measure life? They're living a better life than me.
Yeah.
And I had to really get a hold of that whole concept in my mind about gratitude that day.
I love it. What a great thing though, right? Yeah, yeah, what a great way to check in. You know, I want to talk about family and kids. Obviously, you got kids and you've been married to your kindergarten sweetheart, which is crazy.
A lot of breakups in between though.
A lot of breakups in between? Yeah. Okay, yeah. I can't wait to get into that. Yeah. But real, before we transition, I have my buddy Patrick, Patrick Barry. He's a big fan of Wide Open, the podcast. And he's always like, okay, make sure that you tell everybody. And I think we skipped over exactly, because you weren't always max out the podcast.
No.
We talked about you going into your job. So you did marketing.
I did financial services.
Financial services, and you kicked ass at it, right? I mean, can you brag a little bit about what you were able to accomplish?
As a young man, early 20s, I was making a six-figure income. And then before I was 30, I was earning a seven-figure income. Mid-30s, eight figures.
Uh-huh.
Built a nine-figure cash amount of savings before I was 40.
Yeah.
And so that allowed me from that success to branch off into lots of other businesses. I bought and sold a lot of real estate. I've angel invested. Right now, I've probably got 22 or 23 companies in my portfolio now. I'm a kind of a serial entrepreneur. I love building things from the ground up. I love collaborations. I love connecting in all different industries, from medical to, I'm involved in a vegan chip called Pig Out Chips right now. I'm involved in all kinds of different businesses. But the generator of that wealth initially was the financial services company. And that was predicated on my ability to sell and recruit and help people. And I did, you know, I did really well young at doing that. Thank God I worked my ass off in order to do it. And, you know, I'm really, really grateful because no one supported me and my family when I was doing it either. They all thought I was crazy.
Uh-huh.
So any of you that have people that think you're crazy in your family, welcome to the party.
Yeah.
Everybody thinks you're crazy. So,
yeah.
So win anyway.
I was just telling my kids this morning, I go, you got to have goals, realistic goals, but then you better have some goals that people think you're nuts.
I love that.
Big people think, like, you know what? That'll never happen.
Yeah.
If I would have told somebody, I'm going to be in the NFL one day when I was younger, from the people closest to me, they would have been like, oh, yeah, right.
Yeah, right. You were telling me that when we met too.
Yeah.
And then as a leader, if you're leading an organization or want to lead one, even if it's two people, your job is to sell a big enough vision and a big enough dream that the dreams of everybody that's in your stewardship can fit inside the one you're selling.
Mm-hmm. It's one of the things most leaders lack is their ability to convey a big vision of something significant, of something major. I was reading a book on Steve Jobs, and there's a guy written by a guy named Guy Kawasaki. He's got good stuff. He kind of helped Macintosh get off the ground. But it's called Selling the Dream. Mm-hmm. And he talked about how Jobs was just evangelical about their cause and their mission, and it was infectious. A good buddy of mine now has become Steve Wozniak, who was one of the other co-founders.
Yeah.
And he's just a completely different dude. He's not that dude at all. But Apple doesn't happen if Jobs isn't this visionary dreamer, to your point, where everything thought he was nuts.
Yeah.
Absolutely crazy. But he said, I'm going to build the biggest company in the world. Yeah. Most influential company in the history of the world. And he's probably done that.
Yeah.
And people thought he was nuts in his garage with Wozniak.
Yeah, you're like, the audacity.
Yeah, right.
That'll never happen. Right. But I love it. Let's talk about your, and I'm glad for clearing that up, because I want to make sure people know that, look, it's not just about motivating people. It's it's about, hey, I've done it. I've been there, and I've had the experience and the success at it.
So. I'm glad. I want to say one thing about that. It's why I'm glad you're in this space. Mm-hmm. The one thing that burns me, and I don't spend a lot of time on it, is if you're going to study a mentor, have a couple mentors in business or personal development like we're doing, can you please make sure that they've been successful outside of telling you how to do it? You'll find that the circle is very small of those of us that are in this space that have actually built something significant. That's the only thing. If I'm going to go to the gym and get trained by a trainer, I want it to be somebody in great shape.
Yeah.
You better live what you're teaching me. And in personal development or business, whatever we want to describe this thing we're doing right now, find out if they're successful first. Not that they got successful telling people how to do things they've never applied.
Yeah.
Drives me nuts.
Yeah. Yeah. So. Me too. That's why I wanted to say that about you. Okay. So you said you met your wife, in kindergarten, had some breakups. How long have you been married now?
20 something
years.
22.
22. Do you celebrate anniversaries and
we
stuff
do.
Like that?
We do.
We don't.
You don't. Me and wife, you celebrate every day.
I don't even know. I think we've been married around 11, 12 years, something like that.
That's good for a dude that we have to remember the date. I probably should have done that.
Yeah, so you got to set that precedent early.
Every day is our anniversary.
Yeah. Right, to all the guys out there, don't start that now. If you've been doing it,
you're stuck.
The precedent's been set. You do not think you can change it. I did that from the beginning.
Awesome.
So you've been married a long time. I mean, give me some keys to your relationship. How have you been able to stay together so long?
I'll give you one no one talks about. Mm-hmm. So, and by the way, again, I don't have a perfect relationship. We've had our ups and downs, clearly, but we love each other. And that's obviously the foundation. But I'm going to tell you one that most people are going to roll their eyes at, because everyone goes, well, you better have trust. Mm-hmm. You better communicate, right? You hear that from everybody. Okay. You want to know the truth? If you're going to have a long-term relationship with somebody, this is something people don't talk about ever, but I'll say it. You better stay attracted to them. Mm-hmm. You better have physical intimacy with them. Mm-hmm. And if you don't maintain that part of your relationship, like you keep dating, like, man, you start keeping it spicy all the time, physically, I'm talking about, what starts to happen over time is you start living with just your friend. Mm-hmm. And in most relationships, I have a lot of friends. I don't want to lay next to them every single night.
Yeah.
Right? I got a bunch of really good friends that are male and female, and I don't want to be married to them. And if you allow your spouse to turn into just your friend, that you lose that intimacy, that physical connection. One of the keys, I would say, is I'm super attracted to her still. Uh-huh. And I think she's incredibly...
incredible.
For no reason whatsoever, miraculously attracted to me still. And so I think that's one part of your evaluation. How often do you touch each other? Do you hold each other's hands? At different stages of your relationship, physical intimacy can look different ways. I doubt at 80 years old, we're going to be doing what we do now, but I'm going to be dancing with her in the living room, I hope. When I was dating her, man, interesting thing. It was hard because her parents had a great marriage. It was their second marriage, which usually those are great. They're sometimes better because you figure stuff out, right? But every time I go pick her up for a date, not every time, that's not true. Many times, when you'd walk up to her front door, you could see in their living room. And I get emotional even saying this, but I would walk up to the front door and I'd expect it almost after a while. I'd see Howard and Patricia, her mom and dad, slow dancing in the living room. And there's just music on, no TV. They would just dance together slow. And I don't know what they were doing after that. You know, I don't want to know. But the point I'm making to you is they kept it romantic. They kept physical intimacy in their relationship. And he was in his 70s and she was in her 60s. But they kept that going. It was such a good example for me because my parents, who were very much in love, never touched each other. Mm-hmm. I never saw them say, I love you. They weren't physical at all around us and didn't even touch us very often. I'm real conscious of always touching my kids and hugging them and always making sure they feel me. And so I think that's been one of the foundations of our deal. We do a date night once a week. So we're actually out doing something. And, you know, we're very, very different people. She doesn't have an ambitious bone in her body, no achievement. She could have any clothing she wants. She wears jeans and a t-shirt. There's nothing about her that's that way, but she believes in me. She believes in me. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, people can love you and not really believe in you.
Yeah.
She believes in me. And that's always given me strength and confidence throughout all of our ups and downs or whatever they are. I feel like that's one of the great gifts is her belief in me.
Yeah. I love that slow dancing. I'm like, I'm going to ask my wife to slow dance tonight.
I'm telling you, dude, it's something I should do more of as I say it out loud. It's like, well, it was good. You saw it, but how often are you doing that?
And that's what I love about doing this. Like when I get to sit down with people, little rituals like that and habits and stuff like little stuff like that, that can make such a huge difference. Yeah. Just start, ask your wife to dance one night.
I'm telling you.
Or whatever. So with kids, you guys have, how many kids do you have?
I have a 17-year-old boy and a 16-year-old daughter.
Okay, so you got teenagers. You're in, wow.
Yeah.
How did you guys decide to raise kids together? Did you, is that something you consciously said, okay, this is how we're going to do this, or is it, has it evolved?
It's evolved and we don't agree on it all the time. So I'm much more of a disciplinarian. She's much more their friend.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? So it's a little bit of that dynamic all the time where I'm like, look, we're their parents.
Yeah.
And she's their friend. So there's a balance there. Probably has worked out pretty good. We're both their friends. I think you know what I mean. But
yeah,
I'm much more likely to be like, hey, that isn't, no. We're fixing this shit. So what we did do, though, it kind of fell into our role. She always wanted to be a mother. Mm-hmm. Like since we were little kids, I knew that she wanted to be a mom. She had a career before this, but when we had children, she decided to stay home and raise our children. So I believe in it. It's fine if you have nannies. We've never had a nanny. Never had a nanny, never had anybody care for our kids. We've raised our children. We've picked them up from school. She's cooked most of their meals. I've been at every ball game. You know, I'm more like, I guess, a traditional raising in a world where that's not very common anymore. That's not right or wrong. It's just what we've done.
Yeah.
And so my financial success has afforded her time. So although I might not have had all the time, as I've been busting it and winning, it's afforded my children to have thousands and thousands of hours with their mother. And I'd like to think enough of my own as well. And I think that probably my children's best friend is their mom.
Yeah.
And their role model is me. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a pretty cool combination between the two of us. Certainly have problems with family like every family does, but there's love there. There's I think a pretty darn good example, and they have a world-class mother. I'm a good dad. She's an amazing mother. So they scored.
Any type of principles that you were trying to instill in them?
She's better at it than me, but we have faith in our home. So whether you have that or not is whatever your faith is. I don't preach that, but we do pray together regularly. We pray before every meal. My kids understand that she's done a great job of doing something that I think all the spouses should hear. She has framed my hard work well for my children so that my children believe daddy's leaving to go help people. Yeah. Not dad's going to work. So they don't resent when I'm gone doing what I do. And so she's framed it since they were little kids. They've really believed almost like I'm a doctor of people's lives, you know? So daddy's going to save people. Daddy's helping people. And I think to this day, my children don't resent the amount of work that I have to do because their mother's framed what's going on so well. So I think that's a big deal. And I think just the principles of contribution, of giving to people, of it's hard when you're raising children in affluence.
Yeah.
It's hard in every area. I shouldn't say that it's any harder, but one of the things you certainly worry about with when there's affluence around them is, are they understanding work? Are they understanding humility? Are they understanding faith? Are they understanding contribution? I think both of them, as I observe them, they kind of get that their real happiness is going to come from giving to other people.
Yeah.
So far.
You know, when I look back in my childhood, we didn't have anything. We're definitely lower income, especially at the beginning until I met my stepfather. Then we got a little bit more money, but one thing that that I've been really, you said it's affluence. It's hard to raise kids because they'll never know what it's like to want something, and which is not a bad thing. I don't think it's a bad thing at all. But I know what my parents, that my mother did for me. She always was contributing to family members, to people. We moved around a lot, but when people would come over and help us move, she'd cook them dinner. She'd invite them into our home. I have three adopted brothers from high school that came to live with us. You know, it's like, that's the type of family that we heard. So it gives you empathy as a child and it helps you to take yourself out of the center of things. And I think especially for people, it doesn't matter if you've got money or not. If you could, the number one thing, at least in my opinion now, is you teach your kids empathy and you teach them contribution. Whatever they do in life, they're going to be better at it. And I think they're going to be more successful and they're going to be happier. I think that's probably the number one.
Both interviews we've done, mine and yours, that's my favorite thing either one of us has said, because I so agree with you. I think the difference between sympathy and empathy, sympathy is I feel sorry for you. Empathy is I'll sit with you and help you with your pain and I'll help you through it. One thing I got from my old man that I've tried to show my kids, boy, I love that. I'm going to actually really use what you just said. But my dad, we didn't have a lot, but man, I can't tell you the hundreds of times. My dad's, remember, I described earlier, drinking dude, man's man. My dad would give you the shirt off his back. So my dad, I would watch, never draw attention to it, but if we'd walk into a 7-Eleven or something and there was a dude sitting outside, he wouldn't say anything, get emotional, but I'd watch my dad, we didn't have a lot, walk outside and help that guy out and talk to him. Yeah. I'd watch him, we'd pull off freeways constantly. Pull down the road, my dad would get out, wouldn't say anything, walk down, talk to the person, bring him food, bring him something. I watched him treat people that way. Didn't always treat people perfectly, but I'd watch him just give. You know what I mean? When we didn't have things to give. Man, I hope as you say that, that my children have empathy, that they've seen me show empathy. I think they have.
Yeah.
But what a great piece of advice, man.
Yeah. This part of the show, we like to go to habits and rituals. And obviously you talked about keeping it sexy. Mm-hmm. You're in great shape. What kind of workouts do you do?
Traditional Monday's chest. Monday's chest. Lifting weights. I lift weights. I train 5 days a week. Monday's chest, you know.
Supplements, stuff like that.
I do. People ask me that all the time. Like, hey, you're 50 years old. You know, are you on any supplements? So I've always taken in a ton of protein, a ton of everything. And I just started taking some peptides, which I'm not advocating for, but I'm not going to lie to people when they ask me about it. I mean, I literally just started. I don't know that I'll continue to do it, but my hormone levels are pretty low. So I'm evaluating that at my age, at 50, you know, should I do something about that? But I'm real disciplined in what I eat. I've tried, you know what it is? I was much bigger 2 years ago. I probably lost 20 pounds of muscle. I'm just sort of consistent with my habit. I'm in the gym. I crush my hour and I'm out. I'm not in there 3 hours. I'm not in there 7 days a week. But I'm in there every damn Monday, every Tuesday. I get my hour, I put in my work, and I leave.
What about sleeping? You big on sleep?
I am.
I don't, 7-8 hours a night?
Yeah, I've dialed that down. I talked about that in my book, actually. I've actually reduced my sleep now to about 6 hours, although I'm not sure I'm right. But I have reduced it just out of time. I did it incrementally by 15-minute segments. I think sleep is huge to produce growth hormone in your body, for recuperation, for rest. There's this sort of thing in the world now where like I work on 3 or 4 hours sleep and I've done that, but I actually believe now that I've done a lot. I've had people on my show that have done sleep studies. What I do because I've reduced the amount I sleep is I do have a lot of rituals that I think get me into deeper sleep, REM sleep longer and faster than what I was doing before. So I do have a few things that I do for that because I'm about 6 hours.
Do you meditate or anything like that?
I meditate. I do walking meditations on the beach about every single morning. I used to be a sitting meditator, but I've learned to do walking meditation because I think it's anchoring some of these things I want to anchor in my body as I'm doing it. But I sleep on a thing called a chili pad.
Yeah.
It's a cooling pad. I keep the room very cold when I sleep. It's very dark. I get off my phone. I don't do any blue screen stuff 30 minutes before. I don't eat 2 hours before I go to sleep. Typically, that doesn't mean there ain't a Saturday where I'm pounding wine and eating too much before I go to bed. But most of the time, I'm pretty ritualized about getting good sleep.
Name one thing you can't live without.
One thing I can't stop doing is my cold plunge in the morning. I'm addicted to doing a cold plunge. I jump in the ocean, the lake, if I'm living there, or I jump when I was broke. I jumped in the swimming pool at my apartment complex when I was young and broke. So I can't live without doing some state change early in the morning.
Yeah. Cold showers?
Cold showers. Okay. It's something cold every morning. Cold shower, cold plunge, cold something. Plunge. I've been doing that way before it was cool to do it. Like way before, 20 years worth.
Really?
So I can't live without doing that.
I just started that a couple years ago. But
and one of the things that happens too is it's just hard. You're doing something hard to start your day, right? This is difficult as hell to do, and you've done something really difficult to begin your day. It gives it momentum.
What job would you be horrible at?
Because I get asked to do it a lot. Politics. No. I'd be a terrible politician because I talk pretty good and I've got a couple bucks and, you know, business like you do it. I'd be terrible at.
I wonder why. Why you think,
I would be. I wouldn't want to raise the money. You have to raise a ton of money as a politician. And I wouldn't want to be like obligated to groups of people that had supported me. So maybe if I funded it all myself, I'd be okay, but I'd be terrible at politics.
You got to kiss a lot of ass. Too.
That's exactly right. I'd like that. Could you do that?
No.
No.
I don't think so. I mean, you know, I can kiss ass with the best of them, I guess, but mm-hmm. just be honest. Just look for something to
come. What if it was every day?
Honest.
This kissing ass every day.
There's and the just, disappointing people too, like, because you can't make everybody happy.
That's talk about social media. Imagine being a politician in this day and age, like literally automatically out of the gate, at least 40% of the people. People think, well, Obama was so popular compared to Trump. Really? Okay. Maybe like 5 points more popular, or 8 points. There's still 40% of the people that just hated him no matter what he did, right?
Yeah. So
I don't want that.
Too much home teams. I think it's like, hey, I was born in LA, so I got to be a Ram fan. It's like, oh, I'm a liberal, so I got to be a Democrat or something.
Isn't that
like
true?
That. So I got to vote Democrat no matter what.
Typically, like, politics and religion you were born into for the most part. You're exactly right.
what kind of food? What's your favorite food? What food would you want to make healthy? How about that one?
Pizza.
Pizza.
Any Italian food. Spaghetti and pizza, lasagna. If you could make all that crap like pure protein with no fat in it, it tastes the same way.
Damn.
I'd be very good.
You a dessert guy? You like cakes and
stuff
like that?
Yes, man. I like bad food. You know what's crazy about doing all these shows? You sound way more together than you really are. Like, I love bad food. I'm lazy. Like, I have to work at this shit. Like, I love bad food. I love dessert. Last night, or 2 days ago, 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I haven't done this in years. It's 3 o'clock in the afternoon. I'm like, I won't say the word. I'm like, F it. I made this huge bowl of ice cream, ton of hot sauce, whipped cream for no reason. I'm watching Dr. Phil just eating ice cream at 3 o'clock. I love that crap.
How'd you feel afterwards?
Oh, horrible.
You're like, oh, miserable.
It's horrible.
This is great. All right. In your opinion, what's the next big thing?
AI.
Mm-hmm.
I think, there's a lot of big things, but I do think it'll be something also. I'll give you one more thing since it's relevant to what we're doing. I think one of the next big things is communicating directly with large crowds of people that is not social media platform based. Mm-hmm. I think people are frying on the social media platforms and want a different form of direct communication. So I think AI and things like that will have an awful lot to do with that.
Mm. Final question. What's one area of your life that you'd like to improve in that you're wide open to learning more about?
Health. I had a heart attack when I was 30. I'd like to improve my overall health. I'd like to live a long time. I'd like to be here for a really long time. There's lots of areas that I need to improve in. My initial gut when you said that was my own empathy for people.
Mm-hmm.
My own lack, my continued growth in not judging people and accepting people as they are. It's something that when you coach people and mentor them, right, it's like you see the better version of them. And sometimes the flip side of that, the negative, is you can become pretty judgmental as you assess people. But for me personally, it'd be my health, man. I want to live a long time and I want to live healthy. Watching my dad go through what he's going through right now, the most precious thing we all have in our lives is our health. You can't enjoy anything when you're not healthy. It takes away your joy in every single area. So I want to do things to maintain my health and my wellness and my fitness long-term.
Mm.
Yeah.
All right, Ed. Thank you for coming on the show, man.
I appreciate it, dude. This was awesome.
Thanks,
thank you.
Sweet.